You are listening to Faith is Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Road. Each week, we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. This week on the Roundup, checking in on the metagame in Pioneer after last week's BNR. Then on the flashback, our testing results with Tome Diviner, Narset's Undoing, and Green-White Enchantress. Finally on the flashback, new decks with 7 white cards from Coruscant 2021. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faith is Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 67 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson in Minneapolis, joined as always by my guy on the left coast. He is Damon Alexander. Damon, what's popping?
Hey, not too much. Just, still 2020, I guess. Trying to get outside when I can, go camping, backpacking, otherwise the usual. How about you, David?
Yeah, just surviving. It's been a hell of a year already, and it's only August. Somehow we still have 5 more months to get through. I'm not sure.
We made it to August. How that happened?
Yeah, exactly. The stupidest month, as they say. And joining us after his first week off ever is the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Dan Schriever. Dan, what is going on?
Hey guys, I wish I could say that I'm coming to you relaxed after a vacation, but these last 2 weeks have just been a harrowing, stressful couple of weeks. My wife and I, we moved from Connecticut down to North Carolina, so I'm coming to you now from Durham, North Carolina. And I guess that actually makes us the second spikiest podcast in all of Central North Carolina. Fans of the MTG Grindcast, of course, know that they've always had their tagline be the spikiest podcast in all of Central North Carolina. And with a little bit of change in their cast, I think Collins Mullen left the show. I figured, there's opportunity. Why not give them a little bit of friendly competition? So here I am. Putting them on notice, we're here for it. The spiciest podcast, perhaps, in Central North Carolina.
Safely ensconced in your new digs, completing your COVID-19 move cross state that does sound very stressful.
Yeah, I mean, we hope you brought your best competition to our show tonight, Dan. Yeah, we thought we couldn't do this without you until we did last week. but no, seriously, we're happy to have you back.
It's good to be back. But yeah, I mean, these last 2 weeks, we were really lucky to have great guests. We had Mana Symbol, Zach Ryle 2 weeks ago, and last week, Ever Mohan, Aspiring Spike. Fantastic episodes, I thought. They turned out really well. If you haven't heard those yet, definitely go back and check them out.
So we will get into the comings and goings of the Magic world, but first, of course, we have some housekeeping at the top. As always, we like to give a big shout out to our Patreon, and we have a new Patreon who is Dart M. Is that a D'Artagnan reference, or what's going on? We don't know.
The Tyrone Shoelaces thing is just has you shaken forever, David.
Well, I just always want to make sure, these people are nice enough to reach out to support the pod. So any puns or whatever, I'm not the biggest pun fan myself, but I want to make sure those are getting their due respect.
As far as I know, this is the real name. So shout outs to Dart.
Yeah, shout outs to Dart M. Thank you for joining the Patreon. And a big shout out to Arun S. and Bran Flakes, who have increased their pledge. I think Bran Flakes is a joke. It's not a reference to like Bran from
Game of Thrones.
Yeah, Game of Thrones.
The House Stark and House Flakes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so big thanks to all our patrons. Of course, if anyone would like to support the show, patreon.com/faithisbrewing is where you can sign up. We do have a number of benefits that we give you as a way of saying thanks for supporting the show. Of course, you get Discord access, you get access to our extended show notes, and we have other rewards as well, all the way up to merchandise. We now have our playmats already as well. Another thing that we've been doing lately with the help of one of our listeners, Brian M., is we've been running Faithless Brewing Community Leagues. This is something that, as the year of our Lord COVID-19 continues, and we're still unable, for the most part, to play Magic and Paper, is kind of a way of trying to fill that void of playing a little bit of friendly Magic with someone who's not just a stranger on the other side of the Magic Online screen on the internet. So we have kind of a Brewers League going. We just finished our second iteration of it. And our champion of that league was none other than our very own Damon Alexander, who went 8-0. Is that right, Damon?
I think I got a bye the first round after Mana Symbol refused to play another match with his all Nicole Bolas' deck. but we'll take it. Feels good to be on top.
So 7-0, you crushed the squishy brews with your tier 1 Blue Moon strategies.
Week 1 was Modern with a brewing restriction around certain cards. I decided to build my spikiest deck until Dan showed me his Cordial Vampires list. And so I took that and faced against a mono black sacrifice deck. Sacrificing versus Cordial Vampire is a bad idea. Next week, Modern, no holds barred, any deck is legal, straight to Blue Moon. Actually, that didn't seem fair, so I played Blue Black Slither Wisp. I feel like you can't fault me for that. Next week, it's not my fault I played Treasure Cruise, Dig Through Time, Git Probe, Mental Misstep, and Snapcaster with all those cards in Blue Moon.
That was week 3 was the restricted Modern, where everything that is currently banned, you're allowed to play one of.
Right, right.
Which was an interesting sort of experiment, because at first I thought, you know, I don't like the idea of Highlander as we talked about during our Lutri episode, our now infamous Lutri episode, where I insisted that there's nothing to learn from building around one ofs, and yet it's hard to just choose just one card when you have the whole ban list at your disposal. So why not just play one of each and get to revisit all your old friends?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the restriction certainly hurts some of the banned cards. Like, you're going to have trouble building a second Sunrise deck with only one copy, whereas Git Probe and Treasure Cruise and Dig Through Time just kind of go straight into a blue deck that doesn't build around them. And then last week we had a 100-card Modern Highlander, but Modern legal, like, in terms of formats, again, with no banned cards. And so they were fundamentally restricted by the format rules. So kind of like Canadian Highlander, but without the vintage card pool and point system.
American Highlander, I believe, is what Mana Symbol called it. That was his prize for winning the first community league, was he got to choose the format for this one. So he, being a good Canadian citizen, chose American Highlander, which is somehow less regulated, more freedom, but also somehow slightly worse all around. So I see you, Zach. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah, coming in a distant second place in this list, we have none other than Daniel Schriever.
I know, you had a two-match lead on me the whole time, but it was a great time, and again, just a great way to connect with people and just see some really cool brews in action. I'm hoping we can revisit some of those soon. So thanks again to everyone who has participated. Thanks again to Brian for putting that together, and as always, if you want to come play with us, come chat with us, come hang out, patreon.com/faithlessbrewing, that's where it's all happening.
Yeah, we should have Season 3 showing up in a couple weeks, I believe, with a Pioneer focus.
Absolutely. So, speaking of Pioneer, I heard a lot about Pioneer last week from both of you guys, as well as Aspiring Spike. What has been going on in this format?
Well, they no longer decided that all these decks had a good place in the metagame and that they had, you know, pluses and minuses against each other. So, they had to take immediate action. One thing Wizards doesn't do is delay tough decisions. So, I think in the wake of the unbanning you had in the sort of normal leagues, the standard mix of people just trying cards that they hope are good, right, in the post-ban world. And as we referenced last week, a lot of those decks had actually sort of been tried and determined to be bad. And in the absence of new technology, I think they just got steamrolled even in the leagues. But I think in the sort of competitive metagame, we are starting to see a little bit of a shakeout towards, you know, some of the top-tier decks that were good before. And I think the addition of Uro has kind of created additional decks that can also take that place in that tier 1, tier 1.5 kind of range.
Yeah, so last week, David, you said that, you know, people sometimes pretend or forget that there was already a metagame before Theros. And if you sort of rewind two or now three sets to that metagame, has there been anything from Theros, from Ikoria, from Core 21 that has really made that tier 1 meta look different from how you remember it? Or how would you assess the top tier, you know, one and a half weeks into this post-BNR world in Pioneer?
Well, I think the other thing we have to remember is Oath of Nissa got unbanned. So that was a card that was showing up a lot in a lot of these Land of War Elf decks, and I think it fits in very well into the sort of mono-green Planeswalker list that Aspiring Spike designed. Love playing in the, you know, in the before times, and I think now that is one of the best decks in the format. Doomwake played it to an undefeated run in one of the challenges. I don't think he lost a single match in the Swiss or the top 8. And I think that Uro's addition both makes Sultai Delirium a deck, which we talked about quite a bit last week, and I think it has really improved the Niv-Mizzet deck. So those are kind of the two like Uro decks, if you take that as a format type. And then I think the Azorius Spirits, because of the counterspell, and if people who are regular listeners know, I mean, we said it the day it was spoiled. This is a card that can make the main deck of Spirits and transform that deck, and I think it has. So,
yeah, nobody can deny that deck is now sailing at lofty heights. So, yeah, it seems like Spirits, 5-color Niv, mono-green Walkers, Azorius Control are all the kind of top decks. I've seen blue-black controls in the decks in the queues, but not really in these challenges. I guess they're not shaking out too well. People are already complaining about the heavy doses of Niv and Mono Green Walkers. I've heard it called Mono Green Yahtzee.
I don't understand that reference. What does that mean?
I'm not totally sure, but basically in Yahtzee, you're just trying to like roll some dice and see what happens and not really making too many strategic decisions. And Mono Green Walkers is kind of like, is your opening hand a couple elves, a couple lands, a couple walkers? Yeah, that's great. Do you get to the late game and top deck walk instead of elves? That's great. But there's a lot of ways that can go wrong, obviously. You can kind of flood out by drawing all the mana sources in the deck. And if you do it at the wrong time, then you lose the game.
And I do think that's a place where Oath of Nissa has really increased that deck's percentages. Oath of Nissa is replacing a land. I think they would normally run like 22 lands. Now they're down to 19. So that means they've basically like cut 2 to 3 lands and replaced them with Oath of Nissa. So in the late game, what that means is what typically would be a land is a card that will find you, you know, your Hydra. It'll find you something else other than another land drop. So just that change alone, you know, once you get past turn 3, all that deck wants to draw are these 4 and 5 mana planeswalkers. And Oath of Nissa is a card that, you know, helps you find them.
That's an interesting sort of deck construction lesson. So if you have a deck that does not have access to Oath or some other cantrip, Seer of Visions, whatever the case may be, and you get the opportunity to add those cantrips, like how many of the cards that you chop are going to be lands? If you're saying that the mono green Karn Walkers deck cut 3 lands for 4 Oath of Nissa's and you know, cut 1 other spell, does that mean that the original pre-Oath deck was playing more lands than it really wanted to, just because you need to like get your land drops to hit your Jadelight Rangers and stuff?
Yeah, I think so. And I think you can look at the deck before Oath was banned. I think we even talked about when Oath was banned. I mean, 2 or 3 of the slots that had to replace Oath were lands. So, I mean, it is a thing that happens. People, especially in game 2 and 3, are going to try to kill your elf on turn 1. So you can't just keep, you know, a land or 2 lands and an elf and think you're going to get to, you know, play your 3 mana play on turn 2. A lot of times what's going to happen is they'll kill your elf, you're going to be delayed in playing your Karn. Forget about accelerating it to it. You might not ever get naturally to 4 land until turn 5 or something. So Oath of Nissa helps that problem early in the game, hitting your land drops. And then in the late game, it obviously just turns into a Nissa or a Karn or whatever else. So yeah, it's just, I mean, I'm not telling tales out of school here. A 1-mana Ponder-like effect, which I think is the best cantrip in the format, is going to increase your consistency. And that was what that deck had. It flooded out a lot. Before, and now you have these cards that function as lands in the early game and as, you know, win conditions in the mid to late game.
Yeah, the importance of hitting your land drops in a ramp deck can't really be understated. If you miss your second land drop, but you're playing Llanowar Elves, those are actually just worse than playing a forest. So you actually do want to make sure you hit, you know, 3 lands on turn 3, 4 by turn 4. The rule I've heard for cantrips is basically a kind of 2-to-1 ratio where if you have 2 cantrips that can replace, you can cut 1 land. And so cutting 3 lands for 4 Oath of Nissa's seems a little bit off on that ratio. But obviously, you know, rounding is funny sometimes with deck construction.
So I'd like to ask you guys, just shifting gears briefly, about Niv to Light or 5-color Niv, whatever they're calling it these days. Surprised to see this consensus arrive that this is just going to be like a tier 1 gatekeeper deck for Pioneer for the immediate term. In the Saturday challenge, I think there were 8 Niv decks in the top 32, so it's almost 25% of the winner's metagame is 5-color Niv. In the Sunday challenge, I think it was still tied for first with all the other, I think maybe, there were maybe 4 copies. The build seems to be evolving. I'm seeing lots of Deathrite Shamans. I'm seeing Oath of Nissa's in the deck now. They're all Yoram builds for the most part. What do you guys make of all this?
Well, all the 5-color Niv players in Modern African Astrolabe band flocked to Pioneer to have their chance to cast. I'm just kidding. I somehow was being brought up in the school of Modern 5-color Niv. I find the Pioneer version to just be slightly painful. But the deck is clearly quite powerful. I mean, the end game of just playing a 5-mana 6-6 flyer and drawing 3 or 4 1-for-1s is really puts it over the top. And unlike Modern, there aren't quite so many decks that get underneath it too fast in like a combo sense. The deck's packed with 1-for-1 removal against creature decks or things like that.
Can you explain this Deathrite Shaman to me? I mean, it's a 4-of here. There's not a Satyr Wayfinder or some other thing, right? There's just the Fable Passages. There's, you know, maybe you discard a card to Mahiri once in a while, but beyond that, I mean, is this just meant to be like an efficient thing to do? You know, it's only 1 mana. It has a bunch of potential modes.
I haven't played with or against the deck too much, but there's a lot of decks that just have subtle graveyard synergies. And so sometimes Deathrite Shaman will ramp you off of your lands. If there's a Fable Passage in either player's graveyard or somebody happens to cycle, Fetid Pools or who knows what. But also just against like a mono black deck, it can take care of their little pesky threats that your, you know, Oath of Kaya's can take care of once, but you have to get rid of forever. Against mono red, it's a form of life gain. The card really just does a lot of things, and the deck is basically, you know, when you want to play multicolored cards, there just really aren't many options at 1 mana. The only option is a hybrid mana cost card. As we learned in Modern, you kind of had to make sacrifices at that slot in terms of Niv hits. But we didn't have Deathrite Shaman as an option. So even though it's clearly a little bit worse without all the fetch lines of Modern, I think the card is still seems plausible.
Yeah, I found this inclusion really interesting. In the pre-days before whatever the new metagame was developed, there were no Deathrite Shamans in any of the Niv lists that I look back at. So it must be a new technology that somebody added and then everyone just kind of copied it. They do now have cycling lands, so I think a lot of these lists are playing, I guess it depends on the list, up to like 8 or 10 of these triomes. So you have a lot more likelihood to have lands in your graveyard. Because there's a lot more control decks, Fable Passage is much more likely to be on both your side and your opponent's side. And the printing of Uro means you basically want a main deck way to answer it. And then you're playing Urion, so you need to increase your density of hits for Niv that are still reasonable. And I actually don't think that there's that many. So I think all those combined to playing this card, I mean, like Damon, I have not played the Pioneer version of this deck ever, so I'd have to see it in action. But yeah, I'm kind of surprised to see it myself. You know, this was a card that people were super excited about when the format first came into being, and I think Caleb even had to put like a little reminder text on his stream, like, this card is bad in Pioneer, stop asking me about it. It's seeing a lot of success. You know, it's interesting. I think the Pioneer version of Niv is much better now than the Modern version ever was in terms of its place in the metagame. I mean, it literally is one of, or if not the best deck in the format. It deals the best with the Urion extra mana clause. Yeah, I mean, it's just a pile of removal, and Uro changes a lot of things. It ramps to Niv faster if you need to do that. You do all your 1-to-1 trades and you don't draw Niv-Mizzet. Uro is a card that turns into your card advantage engine as well. So I do think that Uro was a huge addition, and this really is basically an Uro deck, I think, more than anything else.
I would say it's a Triome deck. I think the Triomes were a huge injection of consistency. We were playing, you know, you can play a few of the tap lands that, you know, Frontier Bivouac, etc., and in the tri-land sense, but with these, just they're so good in the early game and so good in the late game, and only so, you know, somewhat awkward but okay in the mid game, that the numbers of tap lands the deck plays are higher than we were able to before.
Yeah, the deck was playing, you know, the temple cycle in large quantities in some iterations. I think Paolo Vitor Dominarosa's deck that he took to a top 8 at the Players Tour had a bunch of temples. If you're going to play tap lands, you might as well just have Triomes and have perfect mana, more or less perfect mana. I played against Niv just today, actually, and I was amazed they never struggled to cast anything. You know, usually when you get to 5 and they start tapping things, that's, you know, your last prayer when you're going through the phases of grief. You just check and maybe they don't have all 5 colors, but, you know, now they always have all 5 colors.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if the Modern deck, even without its Lord and Savior Astrolabe, can work. I mean, there you have fetches for the Triomes. The only fear is it doesn't get around Blood Moon in the same way that Astrolabe does. It also doesn't synergize with Teferi Time Raveler like Astrolabe does, or the million other little things Astrolabe did. But still, I don't think you don't see a lot of Blood Moon in Modern right now either.
So one other deck I want to ask you guys about, Naya Winota, Winota Jordan of Forces, card that we have touched on, although we have not actually featured it in any given week. But This is a card that looked like it was going to maybe break through in Modern even. It was great in Standard, banned or suspended, I suppose, in Historic. Pioneer seems to be like the format where it's at the right power level to be a top tier deck. I've heard some rumblings that, you know, this is looking like one of the strongest decks out of the box. The results don't quite back that up yet, but it has shown up in these challenges over the weekend in some numbers. How do you guys feel about this build of the Winota deck?
Yeah, so I actually am not a believer at all in the Winota list. I think it was a interesting kind of metagame call when the format was super combo-y because you were really discouraged from playing removal main deck. And it was a way to sort of like, it was really a combo deck. It wasn't an aggro deck. So if it didn't draw Winota, it really couldn't win. But with Winota, it basically tried to like, you know, get you, you know, and by turn three, all of a sudden you have them dead. And because they're not playing, you know, cheap removal, they can't interact with your early plays, and they maybe don't have a way to interact with Winota. I think what we're seeing is people going to these kind of grindy mid-range decks that are a little slow. People were excited to play Abrupt Decay again. That was a card both Spike and I mentioned last week. Well, Abrupt Decay does not kill Winota. And what you're seeing, all these decks that we list have a bunch of sorcery speed removal. Even blue-white control is playing Azorius Charm, so that lets you attack first before you actually get to deal with Winota. So I think it's, again, I don't know that it's a very good deck, but I think it is an interesting way to attack the metagame. If you're playing a bunch of decks that don't have the right interaction, and even like Niv-Mizzet is a pile of removal, but none of it is instant speed for the most part. You know, they're playing 3-mana Teferi, Oath of Kaya, etc. These are all fine cards, but they don't interact positively with getting somebody with Winota. So maybe it's the right move, maybe it's not. I am actually kind of a bigger fan of the red-white version. I think the Naya version actually has terrible mana. When we were tooling around with our sort of red-green decks and we were always considering adding another color, that actually seemed really hard to do. And that's been my experience playing them, is they are missing their colors all the time. They have to play a bunch of pain lands. It's actually quite easy to race them. And if you are playing the right removal, the deck is very easy to beat. I mean, without Winota, it's pretty anemic.
I mean, to me, the deck plays, first off, Winota's a powerful card. I think we learned this during our various attempts in Rogue Refinery. And it plays, you know, turn one Elvish Mystic into turn two Legion Warboss on the play is a hard start for a lot of decks to play against. And meanwhile, it has spicy new cards like Garrick's Harbinger, which, again, if you play that turn two on the play against a mono black deck, I mean, like, let's go to game two. And even a lot of decks just will have trouble with these sorts of aggressive starts. Voice of Resurgence is really good against the Niv-Mizzet decks or the blue-white decks. So it's playing a bunch of good cards. The Winota angle, obviously, there are certain matchups that it will struggle against, like just a bunch of removal this deck will struggle with. But it has the payoffs and the fast starts to really get through that a lot of the time. I agree with David, though. I think that the deck does fold to itself a lot of times, thanks to the mana base.
And again, this might be a personal thing just because I played it several times over the course of this week and just absolutely farmed it every time. Like, it was never close except for one time when I basically was just host. So maybe if I start playing, well, we'll talk about it later in our deck discussion, but the decks that we're choosing this week will give Winota players a nice running start at smashing our face in. So
I will just say that I found it interesting to see these Winota decks picking up Tithe Taker in sometimes the full four copies. They had already been playing Voice of Resurgence as a nice card that synergizes with both the Winota and the Eldritch Evolution. Those are your functional fifth through eight copies of Winota. Voice also just like protects you from anyone who's trying to get you at instant speed, hoping to catch your Winota the turn you play it. If you try to do that and they just have a voice in play, you're suddenly in a lot of trouble. You're going to have to give them a lot of elementals, and this deck is all creatures. So voice made a lot of sense to me, assuming that you just sort of imagine you have perfect mana. Tithe Taker has a somewhat similar range of effects. It taxes the opponent's mana on your turn, and it also leaves behind a body when you go do the Eldritch Evolution. That body is a spirit, so it will trigger Winota. But yeah, I mean, on the whole, the deck just looks really weird to me. The choices for creatures are just really strange. I mean, beyond the elves, the Elvish Mystics, and the Goblin Rabble Masters, you just got all kinds of bizarre stuff. Like, Garrick's Harbinger is still in you know, two to four copies, depending on the build. Ingress Marauder is just like the combo finish, but that's not a card you want to cast. So I don't know about this deck still. I feel like there's a better build out there. We just either haven't found it yet, or we need better mana.
I will say the hidden text on that card has actually got me. Like, I had a diviner ready to tap on my turn. It actually costs a mana to use any ability, which I did not read. So, of course, I let their spell resolve, then went to do my thing to remove a counter and then flip my thing in the ice, and I couldn't do it. I was just like, oh.
Whoa, really? Tithe Seeker taxes any activated ability?
Yeah, of you on their turn. So I could not tap my diviner. So, of course, I just flipped it next turn and won absolutely effortlessly. But, even with a free time walk, it's still not good enough. But just good to know, you want to cast Opt in response to it if it's your only mana up, etc. I kept making mistakes against it. You're trained from years of Modern against Voice of Resurgence to do stuff in response. But the new kid on the block, you're not quite used to having to respond to. So
by new kid on the block, Dave is referring to a card that is over a year old.
Well, it's on no play at all in Standard. So and this is the only kind of deck that would ever want to use it in Pioneer as well. So you probably won't see it in any non-Winota builds. But although, again, I would advocate to not play green. I don't think it's worth it. I don't think it's worth making your mana terrible instead of having these Eldritch Evolutions for Winota. I would recommend playing the four red equipment that costs less for every attacking creature. Yeah, I would recommend playing Embercleave with all your goblin token makers and just have good mana. But that's me.
All right. Any other decks you guys want to touch on in this opening segment before we jump into our flashback?
We should mention that SR Tortina came in 23rd with Notion Thief, Narset, Day's Undoing.
Yeah, and that was one of the decks that you guys talked about as a potential comeback kid in the new Pioneer, and I think each of you got to play it. So maybe that's a good segue. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about the list that we played this week in the new Pioneer landscape. Be back in a moment. Stay with us.
So last week we said we were going to try to explore some decks in the new Pioneer that maybe we had fun with before and maybe could see some play again. Now, I actually don't think that the Narset Undoing deck ever got bad. I mean, it was great against Inverter. Day's Undoing was often a one card win against them. But, you know, we were out exploring other things, et cetera, et cetera. But this was kind of an excuse to go back and revisit an old friend. So the combo again in this Narset Undoing list is Day's Undoing with either Notion Thief or Narset Part of the Veils. And then it creates a hard lock with a Gyre Reach. So you can activate that during their upkeep. And then because they draw and loot with an empty hand, they don't get to draw for their draw step. So once you get to that point, you've sort of won the game unless there's some weird thing that they can do out of their graveyard. We had designed this a long time ago. Damon played it to a 5-0 list, and as he intimated, I don't know if this person was inspired by us or not, but somebody even played it in the challenge, and someone 5-0'd with kind of a modified version of it. I don't actually like any of the changes that they made. We can talk about that. So I played the list to a 4-1, and it felt absolutely great. I only lost to some mana stumbles and then the nut draw from spirits. Your game one matchup against control is really good because you have all these flash threats and then you kind of have this combo finish. The tempo sort of aggro effect from spirits is tough to match at times, and my removal suite didn't line up very well. I also think your matchup to mono green is not very good. They are quite a bit faster than you. You kind of have to be on the play game one. You have to be able to kill their mana creature to give yourself time to set up. But yeah, the list felt great, and I know that also Mana Symbol played this on his stream, if anyone is watching him, and he also played it to a 4-1 and said the list felt great. So
yeah, and here I am. I played it to a solid 2-3 finish, so was not able to do as well as I did the last time I took this deck through a league. So perhaps I should have left this one on the shelf for posterity. But I agree with David. I mean, the deck felt good, even though I went up with a losing record. The control matchups, game ones are just hilarious. First off, they don't even know you have Notion Thief for a number of, until they see it, really. So, for example, my blue-white opponent happened to tap out for a Supreme Verdict after I Thoughtseized them in a later turn, and game's over. I would like to draw those cards instead. Thank you very much. Meanwhile, they have Teferi. It doesn't work against Notion Thief or Narset. So you just have all these cards that just naturally line up well against them. And then the deck is loaded with a bunch of removal spells and ways to draw removal spells. And so it gives it decent matchups against the creature decks. Sometimes the mono green Walker's deck is tricky just because you need to be prepared for both the early elf dudes and also for the Walkers. So they have this kind of diversified threat package. And it could be tricky to get your answers to line up properly against them sometimes. I lost a very close match there. Although in game two, I mulliganed to a one lander and I just never drew a second land after six or seven draw steps. Yeah, so I think this deck is definitely worth trying. One tip is just if you're ever casting Days Undoing, make sure you set a stop for your opponent's upkeep because it's the first time you'll have a chance to get priority and you never know if you want to do something with that priority because it just goes straight to their turn. With Notion Thief, you'll have a little bit of a reprieve because you wind up with 14 cards in hand and spend some quality time discarding to hand size. Always an enjoyable feeling. And the deck is just, it's a ton of fun. I mean, the feeling when you pull off the combo, you just feel like you got away with something. And obviously your opponent is, in the zero-sum sense, feeling like they just got robbed of a victory that they rightfully deserved.
So one interesting thing is Damon and my sideboards diverged a little bit. You were playing Other Gusts, which is a card we talked about, and I do think it's well-positioned. I was playing two Thing in the Ice, and that actually felt very good. The card is very hard for decks like Winota to interact with, and it's sort of like a built-in sweeper that also ends the game. It also gave me my only win against Spirits. A quickly flipped thing is like borderline impossible for them to answer, and it buys you enough time to win. But it does have other weaknesses. So the sideboard is very customizable. You can kind of decide what you want to have a great matchup with after board. You know, is it control? Is it combo? Is it aggro? So that, it's worth noting that you don't have to be locked into either of these sideboard plans if you don't like.
Yeah, and one change I would take from my sideboard plan is something Aspiring Spike I saw on a stream that he started playing Jace's Defeat more than Mystical Dispute as his anti-blue card. Just because people are starting to get prepared to prepare for Mystical Dispute. For example, my blue-white opponent was playing Void Shatter as their counterspell of choice. Although I guess actually Jace's Defeat is even worse in that situation because it never works. But it can at least stop their, you know, Teferi or whatever when they keep a bunch of mana up. And so Mystical Dispute is only really good for these critical windows. And sometimes this deck can kind of get this thing where you resolve in Narset into Days Undoing very early. Just have like a Thoughtseize, clear the way, Narset, Days Undoing, a single Mystical Dispute. Stops their answer. Sometimes it doesn't happen that quickly and you go into a longer game and your disputes can wind up dead. But yeah, Aether Gust, that card is just absurd. That card has just steadily risen in my estimation of how good of a sideboard card it is against all sorts of matchups in all sorts of formats.
So an angle that neither of us tried, but I noticed that this Sir Tortina did, was he had extra hand disruption. So he actually played at main. He played two Thought Erasure. I don't like that as a main deck card, but if you wanted to, for instance, maybe play two Duress as a sideboard card to free up your combo against control. Both Damon and I had games that we would probably heavily favored in against other control decks, and if you just don't draw your Thoughtseizes early enough, sometimes you can kind of lose those counter wars because they get to play, you know, uncounterable spells or whatever else. So that's another option you could take is to play Duress or some other kind of hand disruption in addition to your four Thoughtseize.
Yeah, SR Tortina basically cut the Brazen Borrowers, which I've always found to be quite good because before you cast Days Undoing, you bounce their best thing. And then you have, first off, a Brazen Borrow hanging out in exile, so you don't lose it from your hand as you reset your hand with Days Undoing. And also, they lose their card. And so it's a very effective catch-all against all sorts of problematic permanents. And meanwhile, it can come down and help pressure Planeswalkers and do all the things that we've come to know and love out of Brazen Borrower. But on the other hand, these slots don't come for free. And so, for example, SR Tortina is playing four Dig Through Time. We only found room for one. And that card is super powerful. And the Thought Erasers help understand when the way is clear to resolve a Narset into resolving a Day's Undoing in a way that our build is just less able to do reliably. So certainly plenty of room to iterate on the core shell.
If memory serves, when we had initially talked about this deck, we asked how many Dig Through Times you should play. And David, you'd posited that Days Undoing will erase the graveyard too often. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I've not been wanting four Dig Through Time. Certainly not. I mean, the one way you can lose is if you draw all these expensive clunky cards. I mean, so few of the cards that you have actually affect the board. You know, you got all these like Notion Thieves and Torrential Gearhulks and whatnot, and they don't do anything if you don't have other spells. So Dig Through Time is a super powerful card. That is absolutely true. But yeah, I mean, the Brazen Borrower package has just been so good for me, and specifically its interaction against opposing Narsets is so nice. If you don't have the mana to just play your Brazen Borrower on end of turn and kill a Narset after they activate it, you can always just blink it and then go for your combo, like Damon's describing. So that interaction specifically was one of the things I had in mind. But yeah, it's just a great catch-all. It bounces Wilderness Wreck before you go off. It just does everything. It handles all these problematic permanents. You can't really kill lots of things. You know, in this deck, the version that Sir Tartina played, you have one Eliminate, two Heroes Downfall to handle Planeswalkers. So a lot of times you might be executing your combo into multiple Planeswalkers in play that you don't have a way to deal with.
Yeah, I guess now that I look at the list, there's not even Ops in this list. And I feel like if you're playing four Dig Through Time, you need to be playing a lot of Ops. This person got 6-3 in the challenge and I went 2-3 in a league. So what do I know?
Well, we're not done with Blue-Black yet. So I have more questions about sort of the future of Blue-Black post-Inverter. But maybe we should postpone those questions until we hear more from David about the other deck that you played, which was the Blue-Black Tome Diviner deck.
Yeah, so this was a somewhat recent deck we played. Maze Mind Tome was a card you guys both really liked and added in various amounts to modern decks. This was a card I really wanted to exploit with Soul Diviner. I had some reasonable success with it, and Mana Symbol, who guessed it on our podcast 2 weeks ago, had, I think he went 4-1 and really enjoyed it. He had a really fun time playing the deck. He and I actually both picked it up again. I played two leagues. I went 6-4, so I 3-2'd both of them. I had some really, really lucky opponents that stole some chances at 5-0s from me, but you know, that's going to happen sometimes. I think he went 4-1 and really enjoyed his 4-1. So just a reminder here, the interaction here is Soul Diviner removes counters to draw, and we have cards that we don't mind losing those counters from, which is Thing in the Ice and Maze Mind Tome. I think this sort of interaction was a lot more powerful right after the bannings happened because everyone was playing to the board. So Thing in the Ice was actually an awesome card. The interaction that really impressed me was a turn two Diviner into turn three Thing in the Ice, draw a card, and then, you know, have Fatal Push or Thoughtseize as a one mana interactive spell. Those were the kind of openings where you really had a hard time losing. I actually find the Tome to be very slow. It's very clunky. Without the Diviner to really get these free cards, having to pay the extra two mana to draw isn't quite worth it. It doesn't fill up your graveyard for your digs, etc. So there are a few tweaks I would make. I don't think the deck is worth abandoning, but what I found is against these like Wilderness Wreck decks or some of these other like full-on control decks, you have to leave some amount of creatures in. I don't know how many Thing in the Ices you need to leave in. But if you want to leave in your like Soul Diviner Maze Mind package, you still are susceptible to like removal, especially in game ones. They never are, right? They get to play, you know, whatever. Notion Thief if they want, but I mean, they can play, you know, these blue-white decks are playing no creatures at all. So you are just a little clunkier. Your first few turns are really important. I think I'd maybe want to go up to 25 land like we were playing in the Days Undoing deck. But yeah, there is something here, I think. But I do think it's a little limited by you have all these synergy pieces, so you can't quite freely sideboard in and out like you'd like to. It's hard to go to like quote unquote a full control shell when you're still reliant on a two mana creature to be your sort of engine.
I noticed that you've cut all the looting effects by this iteration of the deck. You know, it's at one point you had Teferi, Master of Time. I don't recall if you tried Jace Friend's Prodigy or the Gaia Reach Sanitarium in this build or not. But like you were saying, you might find yourself paired against a control deck quite plausibly, you know, twice a league now or something, and here you're coming to battle with Fatal Pushes and Eliminates and that kind of thing. Or sorry, Heartless Axe, not Eliminates. And if you can't get rid of them, I mean, it's like you're mulliganing six times in the game.
Well, Soul Diviner is just a way better Jace Friend's Prodigy, so there's no way I'm going to put Jace Friend's Prodigy in this deck. Both Zach and I really disliked the 4-mana Teferi. He really disliked it and was like, oh, I'd for sure cut it. I left it in just because I know it's a card that you like, and you know, I wanted to find out for myself. And yeah, it just didn't do anything that I wanted to do. I do think you can kind of cut Heartless Act. I would replace one of them with a Eliminate. I would replace another one with a Drown in the Lock. And so I don't think you need the combo. It never came up where I needed to only cast two spells to flip my Thing in the Ice. And in fact, a lot of times you're removing the counter with a Diviner anyway. So really, like, two spells is all it takes to flip it. And yeah, Heartless Act seems like it's going to be great, but it's like, the restriction comes up more than you think, and Eliminate being able to kill Planeswalkers, 3-mana Planeswalkers, is really important. So like I said, there are a lot of tweaks you could make around this. But the first one I would make is 25 lands. You want to play out to your fourth or fifth land. Maze Mind Tome just needs a lot of mana to do anything. And so you just want to, make your first five land drops. And even with the ops and the Soul Diviner, et cetera, or even Tome itself, scrying for lands, you just want to hit all your first five land drops. So
let's take a step back. We've got two different blue-black decks on the table, both kind of combo-ish, or at least relying heavily on synergies. You got the Narset Days Undoing build, and you got the Soul Diviner Thing on the Ice, Maze Mind Tome, Blast Zone, Planeswalker counter package. Do either of these feel to you like the future of blue-black and Pioneer? Do they feel like, you know, the heirs of Inverter, or is one just like better than the other? You know, they're using similar tools.
When it comes to talking about like the best blue-black deck in the format, we should probably bring to the table the notion of just like a kind of stock blue-black control deck. And this is one that doesn't run any of these combo type things with the Soul Diviners or the Days Undoing, these kind of cards that only work well with synergies in the deck. And they stick to things like just casting four Dig Through Times and Torrential Gear Hulks, along with a slightly better counterspell base and probably a few more sweepers. And these decks are in the queues, and they're good. The decks that we have are clearly more stylized, and I think as a result, more fun. But at least it's pretty open to me which one is kind of like the better deck.
Yeah, I guess my sense, I agree with Damon, that what we should always compare them to is sort of the stock, what would just a normal Dimir control deck be. I actually think the stock control deck is okay, but not great. I think it is just a worse version of Azorius control, because the sweepers in Azorius are better. The counterspell suite is better, and I actually don't really like Thoughtseize in a pure control deck, sort of echoing Spike last week. I think Thoughtseize to clear some of these interactions is kind of the thing that lets you play Magic here. You know, Thoughtseize taking their card that maybe interacts with Narset. Narset just being a powerful main deck inclusion that's really good in the mirror is really interesting to me, especially as all these decks get slower. I actually really like the Days Undoing deck, and I think, I don't know that it's the future of blue-black, but I would prefer to play that instead of like a straight blue-black list. I think the Tome Diviner list is really too cute. I think the way that the format has moved is already to like big control and combo already. And so the interaction that is really powerful is how fast you can flip your thing in the ice. And it's really only good against Winota and certain draws from Mono Green. There's no other like tier one deck that interaction is that powerful against. So I think that's the real limiting factor there.
Yeah, I can't say I'm super excited to be casting cards like Jade's Friend's Prodigy or Soul Diviner into a format just full of removal for them. Everybody comes prepared to handle a bunch of small creatures. And so these cards just get caught in the crossfire. And so I think that of these kind of three choices, I would personally lean towards the Narset's Undoing list. I think you just kind of cut the Jace's from the main deck. And, you know, maybe they can kill a Notion Thief with a removal spells or a Brazen Borrower. That's fine. Those cards usually serve their purpose pretty quickly. Fatal Push isn't even that clean of an answer against either of them if you time it right. And the deck, I think if you tune it right, I think that we're still really kind of converging on what an optimized 75 looks like for that list. But I think that there's just a lot of kind of raw power with what that deck can do. I've also started learning that Days Undoing is not actually a complete piece of blank cardboard without a Narset or Notion Thief. So, for example, I was up against Blue-Black Control, and we just sort of traded resources in the early game. And I was up a land on them. I was down a card in hand. I had four cards. They had five cards. And I was like, well, if I cast Days Undoing, I'll have three cards, and they'll have five cards. And so I kind of net, even though we go to their turn, they draw a card, and it's 8 versus 7. That's actually a better delta than it was before casting it. And of course, if they counter it, then they wasted a counterspell on a card that actually was not very useful without a Narset around. This logic does not work at all against Mono Red. You will die in very short order if you do this.
But yeah, Mono Red was one of the worst matchups for this deck. In the olden days, it's what I'd always lose to. I'd be 4-0 and Mono Red would get me in the fifth match. I mean, there just isn't a lot of Mono Red. You can look at the two Pioneer challenges. I think there was one Boros deck in one of the top eights and very few showing up in the top 16 or top 32. So the Uro like effect has kind of chased them out. And you have this natural counterplay to Uro, because if you just play Narset on turn three and they play Uro on turn three, you haven't done anything. You haven't played any special cards, any graveyard hate, and you just like kind of neutralized Uro. And eventually they're going to tap out to cast it again. You're going to play a Notion Thief, and it's going to be really, really cool.
Yeah, I think taking in everything I'm hearing from you guys, Narset is the card that I want to have on my side. And the fact that it pairs so sweetly with Day's Undoing and this Notion Thief shell just looks awesome to me. So that's probably where I would lean, although I do love cuteness. So hope we haven't seen the last of Tome Diviner either. I got to play one league this week, and since our theme from last week's show was kind of giving some old Pioneer favorites a second chance in the new metagame, I went back a little bit further, actually, a couple of months to when we did our week on Enchantress, and specifically Setessan Champion. I had talked about a green-white build that a friend of mine, Will Setzer, had been working on, where in order to supplement the Enchantress core of like your Setessan Champions and your Eidolon of Blossoms, he had identified Mana Bloom as like the most important card. So playing a full four copies of Mana Bloom, because that is basically a recurring cantrip that, you know, it lets you go off with your engine. You just cast that even X equals zero every turn and just try to just get as many triggers as you can. So that was part of the innovation that Will had done, was four Mana Blooms. And the second part was the specific interaction between Monastery Mentor and Conclave Tribunal. So Conclave Tribunal is Oblivion Ring, but with Convoke. Monastery Mentor is kind of like an Enchantress in the sense that all your enchantments will trigger it. So instead of getting, you know, the classic Enchantress payoff of drawing a card, you get a Monk Prowess token. But that Prowess token actually helps you fuel Conclave Tribunals, because, you know, that's a card you can just cast right away off your random tokens, or if you have a Herald of the Pantheon sitting around or Eidolon of Blossom sitting around. So that was the shell, and I think I had some modest success with it in some leagues. That was all before Oath of Nissa was unbanned, so I thought, why not just try it again? I added four Oath, I trimmed some of the fat, and took this into the queues, and it didn't actually go very well. I kind of got destroyed my first few matchups. I played against a cool red-green dinosaurs list. I played against Black-Green Aristocrats with Bolas of Citadel and Urian Niv-Mizzet, and I barely won a single game out of those. I started off 0-3, was able to salvage a couple wins against Izzet and Sol and a weird teamer deck that didn't really get to show its colors. But a kind of a weak 2-3, I would say, and I was not encouraged by this deck. It seemed really poorly positioned.
How was Oath of Nissa specifically? Did it feel like it kind of upped the power level of the deck a little bit?
It did, and I was encouraged to see that. So I checked Frank Carson's numbers. He did an article on this when Oath of the Gatewatch came out. And I think my build had 39 hits in the main deck for Oath of Nissa. It obviously doesn't find other enchantments, but it finds lands and creatures. And at this point, all you really need is for it to hit something, because you're mostly just interested in having a cantrip that has the card type enchantment on it. So even just like casting it for lands was fine. I was actually often digging for lands. So it was actually quite a nice upgrade. This is a land light deck. It's got 6 mana elves and 19 lands. So the oaths actually helped quite a bit. Without them, I was either playing a couple more lands, which I didn't really want, or a couple of the bad enchantresses like the Satyr Enchanter. I was just like happier having oaths than anything else. So it is a meaningful upgrade for the Setessan Champion strategy, as I think you identified, David, in your black-green Joel Ryle Unbridled Growth Footfall Creator experiments from last week.
So did you find like your removal just wasn't lining up well, or why was the deck poorly positioned in your mind?
Well, in previous formats, the biggest problem was sweepers. So everything that this deck does gets erased by a Supreme Verdict or Solar Blaze or Extinction Event, as the case may be. And I was quickly reminded of that against the Niv-Mizzet deck, where I was just trying to like go off, but none of my stuff has haste. All you can really do when going off is draw a bunch of cards and build a wide board, and then hopefully kill them next turn. That's just not going to happen against sweepers, and especially if they have Teferi Time Raveler in play to like sweep you during your own turn. It's just like a hopeless cause. The other losses, I mean, against the red-green dinosaur deck, you know, this is a deck that I hadn't seen before, but I guess I had been in a couple of 5-0s with Marauding Raptors and Regisaur Alphas, all the way up to Gulta Primal Hungers. I felt like that should have been a favorable matchup, but I found that all of my creatures have 2 toughness naturally, like the Herald of the Pantheon, the Eidolon, and the Monastery Mentor. So they all died to Bonecrusher Giant, and that deck was also playing, you know, some number of Reckless Rage, maybe some shocks too. I'm not totally sure about that. Domri, Anarchar, Bolas. So because I was more of a synergy-based creature deck, just having key removal spells in a timely fashion made me just vulnerable to needing a good sequence off the top of my deck. I felt like I could have won if the cards had come up right, but I didn't actually have that many tools to ensure that I'm actually favored in the matchup. It was more just like, oh, I hope that my draw lines up better than their draw in this green-white versus red-green matchup, and it didn't go that well. Against the black-green Aristocrat deck, they actually have this cool combo finish, and this deck is actually very, very similar to a deck that we talked about during our Woe Strider week, where the goal is to get, you know, both Catacomb Sister and Woe Strider provide tokens and let you scry whenever one of your creatures dies. So if you have something like that in play with a Bolas of Citadel and some life to work with, you can potentially just keep casting cards off the top of your deck. You never run out of spells on top because of the scry effect, and all you could potentially run out of is life from just having to spend all your life on the Citadel. Well, it turns out if you're playing Zulaport Cutthroats, you can just keep going indefinitely on life as well. So the black-green Aristocrat opponent was able to just sort of combo kill me on turn five in the deciding game before I could really get going.
So they just hard cast a Citadel?
Yeah, they cast it off of one of the Scions from Catacomb Sifter and like a Gilded Goose. You can also cheat it out with Priest of Forgotten Gods. That's a 4-of in the deck. So you have like some mana elves from Gilded Goose. You have Priest of Forgotten Gods. Then you have Catacomb Sifter provides a Scion, and Blister Pod as a 4-of can at some point provide a Scion as well for that mana boost. You just need to get to 6 once before the game is over. And if you have a comfortable life total, the Citadel could potentially just vomit not just a huge board into play, but even continue to execute the kill. So it was pretty impressive to see. That deck showed up in the 5-0s, I think, last week as well. So this was a variant of that. So anyway, it was a weird matchup spread. I guess my takeaways were that the mana was still really bad. You know, green and white just has terrible lands. 4-5 village is atrocious. Basic Plains is atrocious in this deck. And cards like Herald of the Pantheon, cards like Monastery Mentor, I mean, they work when the deck is going off, but they don't solve the deck's problems, and they're not enchantments. So really, this deck needs like a Utopia Sprawl or some version of Herald of the Pantheon that is itself an enchantment. And until that happens, I think that the card pool is just too limiting.
Yeah, the Green White Enchantress deck just never really impressed me in Pioneer. Unlike the Legacy deck, this deck just kind of casts some stuff that is just fairly anemic. I mean, the best thing going here is a bunch of Mentor tokens, which certainly are powerful. Meanwhile, the Legacy deck plays this prison role with Elephant Grass and blanking on the card, but it's one that makes you can't take damage and you skip your draw step. And then all of a sudden they go Sarah's Sanctum into Living Wish for Emrakul, the Aeon's Torn. And this deck just doesn't really have lines like that. Utopia Sprawl is a huge loss because it lets you keep casting enchantments without going down a mana. Dan's line of Conclave Tribunal with Monastery Mentor is quite cute because it does let you do something along those lines. But a lot of matches, you know, Conclave Tribunal can't really win games on its own. And there's a lot of games where it can't even really buy you that much time.
Yeah, and the equivalent line to the mana neutral enchantment is if you have a Herald of the Pantheon in play, all of your enchantments cost one less. So that means your Willfellow Haven, which normally costs 2, now is like a Utopia Sprawl. Or your Mana Bloom normally costs 2 and gives you 1 mana back. With a Herald in play, it just costs 1 and gives you 1 mana back. So you can sort of go off, but it requires Herald of the Pantheon, which is otherwise just not a good card.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think I'm just going to put that deck on the shelf for now. There's plenty of other stuff to explore in Pioneer. This is not it right now.
Yeah. If we get our Gothian Enchantress, that's when we know to come back to this one.
Yeah. So another potential weakness of the deck was that, you know, it was a green deck paired with white, and white has just not been a very good color lately in Pioneer, certainly, in Standard, even in Modern. White's been struggling, so our theme for this week's brew session is to try to see what we can do with white. In fact, we couldn't even identify a single card to pin our hopes on. They all looked kind of iffy. So we got a whole slew of white cards that we're going to workshop a little bit and try to squeeze something out of them, like Blood out of the Stone. We'll be right back with those decks after the break. We'll be right back.
welcome back. So our theme of this week is not a card, but rather a color, and that's white. Because as Dan mentioned, you take this awesome green deck, you add white to play these cool enchantments, and then you get dumpstered because the white cards in Pioneer tend to lead you into the 2-3 bracket or worse. So that you, our listeners, don't have to end up in the 2-3 bracket, we will happily lead the charge with our lovely white cards. And so what we have planned for you is not just a single card, but 7 separate white cards to try out and with one list each. So here they are. Speaker of the Heavens, Containment Priest, Griffinary, Angelic Ascension, 9 Lives, Basri Ket, and Stormwild Caprador. So let's see if we can take white out of the dumpster and into the heavens. And our first one to accompany us on this journey is Speaker of the Heavens, which is one coming fresh from M21, or maybe not quite so fresh. It's been a month or two now. And so as a quick reminder, this is 1 white for a 1-1 human cleric that is Vigilance and Lifelink, and tap, create a 4-4 white angel creature token with flying, and you can only use this if you have 7 more life than your starting total, so 27 life for us competitive players, or 47 for any EDH listeners out there. So, David, I know that you've been having your eye on this card. What do you have going?
Yeah, so I think in Modern, the obvious interaction people were thinking about was Martyr of Sands. So Martyr of Sands is a 1 mana creature. It says you may sacrifice it, and when you do, reveal any number of white cards from your hand, and then you gain twice the number of white cards revealed in life. So if you reveal 5 cards, you gain 10 life. So that had been used with Sarah Ascendant, which is a sort of similar card that is a 1-1 lifelink creature for 1. And then if you had 30 life instead of 27, it became a 6-6 flying creature. Well, the 10 life actually became kind of the key. You didn't always have, you know, with Thoughtseize or a Goblin Guide or whatever, you didn't always quite get all the way to 30 life exactly. And the difference between 30 life and 29 life is a lot with that card. So this one is a little more forgiving. You can have less cards in your hand. It itself also has Vigilance, so the turn that you attack with it, you can get that extra life. So you could feasibly play this on turn 1, you know, whatever they thought sees you. You attack with this, you go to 21, then you play your card and reveal it, and you can get extra life in this way. So you only really have to have 3 cards left in your hand with Martyr of Sands to get to your 27. And then because this card has Vigilance, you get your angel right away, and that's quite powerful because now they need to both deal with your Speaker of Heavens before you get to activate it again, and there's a Sir Angel in play that they have to deal with. So the build is sort of like a Soul Sisters type build, you know, that's taking advantage of Soul Warden, Soul's Ascendant. Those are cards that gain life every time a creature comes into play. Squadron Hawk is a card that we see a lot with Martyr of Sands because it kind of helps refill your hand, and then it gives you a bunch of obviously coming to play triggers with Soul Warden, Soul's Ascendant. Auriak Champion is sort of this anti-Jund kind of version of the Soul Ascendant. Ranger Captain of Eos tutors up the various one drops that you need. And then I kind of snuck in this little Heliod package. So there's 2 Heliod and 1 Walking Ballista. Walking Ballista is still legal in Modern and is tutorable by Ranger Captain of Eos. And then I just kind of played 1 Lurrus just because you have all these one drops that will die. Martyr of Sands naturally goes to the graveyard. And you know, Auriak Champion, Thalia, these are high priority 2 drops against certain matchups where you might want them.
So I think the plan of this deck is very clear and straightforward. You know, you have all these 1 mana white cards that gain life, but the question in my mind is like, what's the right number of each effect? You know, you have access to up to 8 copies of Soul Warden and Soul's Attendant. You also have 4 Speaker of the Heavens that gets big, gets a big flyer. Sarah Ascendant is a very similar card to that. Do you want 4 of those? Do you want the full 8? I'm thinking back to like Murder Proc sometimes wouldn't even play the full 4 Sarah Ascendant. They might even only play 3, with the idea being that it's a bad card if you don't have the murder to sort of boost it up. So can you talk about sort of how did you arrive at 8 of each of these effects? So you have 8 of the Sarah Ascendant Speaker of the Heavens type card, and you have 7 Soul Wardens plus 2 Warrior Champions for 9 of that effect.
Yeah, so I think Damon is the first one who said this. If I misquote him, I hope he will correct me. But the real way that Martyr Proc wins is you time out your opponent. They were just trying to set up loops where they gained a bunch of life each turn. They weren't really concerned with winning. This deck is trying to kind of like maximize its chance at that nut draw, which is attack with a 6/6 lifelink on turn two, or attack with a 1/1 lifelink on turn two, and then get a an angel. So in that sense, I wanted the full eight, and the deck is much more bent towards the full on like quickly gaining life plan as much as possible. And then sort of the backup plan is if it all goes to hell, you know, they sweep you or bolt you or whatever else. You kind of have this oops, I win combo with the Heliod walking ballista. So I wanted the full eight copies to your question, Dan, because I wanted to maximize my chance at kind of getting that nut draw, especially against these decks that aren't playing a lot of removal. You see some of these blue-green sort of Uro shells. They're sort of content to use like Uro as their way to gain life and protect themselves. They aren't playing a lot of spot removal. So I think you have a chance to kind of, you know, maybe steal a couple of sort of tempo turns early in the game and build up a board that's pretty meaningful.
Yeah, that makes sense. Got to give a quick shout out here to Gabriel Nassif, who 5-0'd, was that just today, was that? With a deck that had a lot of the same cards in it. But when you dig into the differences, there were actually some large divergences in kind of what each deck was trying to do. So Nassif's build had 4 Sera Ascendant and 4 Speaker of the Heavens. So that much was the same. And the Martyrs of Sands are there as well. Difference is that it seemed like his list was not playing as much disruption. You have Thalia, Guardian of Thraben. Nassif does not. He has a Johnny's Primate instead, which is just like a big beater. Instead, he's going hard on the Heliod combo. 4 Heliods and 4 Walking Ballistas. Heliod presumably is just like a fine card to have when you have all these Soul Wardens, although he's only playing 4 of those, not 7. On top of that, Nassif was also playing full 4 Mishra's Bauble to go with 2 Lurrus to the Dream Den. That's a little bit surprising. I can see how Lurrus is a good card, but the Mishra's Bauble seem like they just get in the way of your Murder of Sands.
Basically, the way I view the difference is that I think There's two decks in Modern. There's Martyr Proc and Soul Sisters, both happily sitting somewhere between Tier 2 and Tier 3. And Martyr Proc to me is this kind of mono-white control deck that features Martyr of Sands to get off the ground, and then it has these kind of weird mono-white cards that help you grind at the late game. Whereas Soul Sisters is just all about these growing a Johnny's Pride Mate type cards very quickly with the Soul Wardens, and as a result has kind of a pretty different matchup spread. And Nassif's list is clearly a Soul Sisters build, and David's build is a little more in the middle. It has all the Soul Sisters in the Soul's Warden and Soul's Ascendant, but then it's playing cards like Thalia and more Ranger Captains and Force of Virtue and Squadron Hawks. So it's interesting to see where we would want to land with this. I would want to think about playing more Lurruses. I think that card is very good. I think that the Mishra's Baubles are fine with the Martyr of Sands. I'm not even sure you need Martyr of Sands that much, or the Squadron Hawks. I mean, you can gain a ton of life with the Soul Sisters. I'm not sure how much is too much. And I think you may as well, like, maximizing the Heliod combo isn't crazy, along with the Pride Mates, just because these cards are the ones that really synergize well with the Soul Sisters versus Sera's Ascendant and Speaker of the Heavens, which work well with Martyr of Sands.
Yeah, if there's no Squadron Hawk, like, Nassif list does not have Squadron Hawk. I'm less attracted by a Murder of Sands, but I really like the Squadron Hawk and the Force of Virtue, as we've talked about, so I'm happy that David's list has those. Yeah, I like the way you laid out the differences, the two different paths. Do you guys expect that Speaker of the Heavens will actually be like a meaningful upgrade to this deck, or is it just more of like a critical mass of rewards and payoffs?
I mean, I think it's a major upgrade to the deck, but I think the deck is, I think Damon was even being generous between Tier 2 and 3. Obviously, these are pretty fuzzy definitions, but I think to kind of do this thing, to maximize your nut draw is very important. I think that's why Nassif is playing the 4 Martyr of Sands even without Squadron Hawk. You are just trying to steal games. You know, on the play, you just have a chance to present, you know, a huge board on turn 2. And maybe for that reason, Mishra's Bauble like helps you search for the right cards. If you're just going to say, I'm cold to combo, I don't care, I'm just going to cut Thalia, I think it's a reasonable thing to do. And he also is being able to shave lands. He's only playing 20. I'm less convinced of the like 4 Walking Ballista in a deck with no ramp at all and only Heliod to give it additional counters. That seems pretty speculative to me, but, you know, Nassif is one of the great deck builders of all time. So I was encouraged to see that this deck did well. You know, I proposed this, you know, my list to the best of my ability. So if you made me play with Speak of the Heavens, what would I try to do with it? And I think there were a lot of questions you guys had about it, but it was kind of encouraging at least to see something with a similar concept. Even I snuck the Heliod combo in there sort of speculatively. He was, like Damon says, he was all in on it. That was encouraging that he was able to have some success. He did kind of intimate in his tweet that he got a lot of help from his opponents, but we take those, so...
Yeah, this deck is going to have very polarized matchup spreads, and Speaker of the Heavens isn't really going to help you with that. This is where I'm not sure that three Thalia, Garden of Fabens is just like, you know, you're putting a Band-Aid on a Burst Fire Hydrant here.
when you need a tourniquet.
Yeah.
I guess the card to me that I would be happy to cut is a Johnny's Pride Mate. I just don't think it's that good. It doesn't matter how big it gets. It just dies to push. It dies to whatever else. And he was playing it with only the four Soul Sisters. So it's not like he has lots of, you know, little incidental pings.
Well, he has four Aureac Champions also.
Sure. But you wouldn't tip. Well, I guess maybe sometimes you would. But oftentimes you don't get to play an Aureac Champion before you get to play your Pride Mate. I mean,
you get your eight Healer's Hawks, by which I mean the 1-1 Ascendant and the 1-1 Speaker. Those are both lifelink cards, so you can curve that.
I don't mind the idea that just the Soul Ascendant card is fundamentally very weak, and so reducing the number of those is something that's attractive to do. But if I was to cut them from our list, I would still try to maybe find a way to like play four Squadron Hawks, for instance. And the Force of Virtue is kind of nice with eight lifelink creatures.
Yeah, and the Blue-Red Prowess deck is turning up to be better than we thought in Modern. It's seeming to place quite well in the challenges, and that deck features four Lava Dart, and Force of Virtue goes a long way towards stemming that problem.
And so maybe the four Aureac Champions are something that you want, you know? I mean, I love Aureac Champion, and so it doesn't take a lot of arm twisting to me to make, maybe that's just the better Soul Sister, because Lava Dart is, like Damon says, going to haunt your dreams.
Yeah, let's go a little bit slower. But that said, up next we have Containment Priest. So this is one and a white for a 2/2 human cleric. Again, on the human cleric trend. Maybe that's White's problem. He needs different creature types. Containment Priest has flash, and if a non-token creature would enter the battlefield and it wasn't cast, exile it instead. And so this card has lived a long life in Legacy as a sideboard specialist against Dredge and Sneak and Show, because printed out of a commander set, I believe. And then it came into our Modern and Pioneer formats we love and know so well. So what do we have here?
So this is a card that I think Damon very correctly pegged when it was spoiled that, you know, it serves this function in Legacy, but the decks that it's very good against there don't really exist in these other formats. So we haven't seen it as a great sideboard choice because there are just better options if you want to hose the graveyard, you know, out of Dredge or something. You don't have to play this creature that's vulnerable to some removal they're going to play anyway. So what I'm proposing is kind of a way to use it proactively, which is specifically its interaction with Eldrazi Displacer and Flicker Wisp allow you to permanently exile your opponent's creatures. So if Containment Priest is in play and you flicker their creature, it never comes back. It just stays exiled. And same thing with Eldrazi Displacer. It does not come back into play tapped. It just is gone forever. So it's basically just your normal sort of modern Death and Taxes shell. I'm splashing green to play Noble Hierarch on turn one. But as always with these decks, there's a ton of options you can try. You can play the four Stoneforge Mystic, you know, two equipment, which plays pretty well with Flicker Wisp. You can play kind of the black Eldrazi package if you want to play Wasteland Strangler and the white-black artifact that exiles a card from their hand. Or you can just play mono white and no green at all, and you can kind of up the count, maybe a Flicker Wisp and Blade Splicer. You know, if you're starting to max out on your Eldrazi Displacers and Flicker Wisps, you do want kind of an additional target. You know, if Containment Priest isn't in play and you can't start exiling your opponent's things, you need something that's paying you off for blinking your permanents over and over again. And for better or for worse, I do think Blade Splicer is about as good as white can do, so...
Well, actually, you have in your notes here that a Stoneforge Mystic package is another option, and I think that plays quite well with being blinked also.
Yeah, you do kind of run out of value after you blink your Stoneforge Mystic once. You've probably got your, you know, sort of Feast and Famine and Batterskull, or maybe you want to play the two Batterskulls because you don't need your mana that much in this deck. But yeah, I mean, that first blink is often all you get, and Flicker Wisping your own Batterskull after they kill you, the germ is a thing that I've done many times, so... That might just be the way to go. It also kind of helps your burn matchup, which is often something you need a bunch of sideboard slots against. And so being able to cut those slots is very worthwhile. It lets you, you know, sharp your other matchups.
Are you concerned at all about like anti-synergy within the build, specifically between Containment Freeze and Aether Vial? You know, Aether Vial is the best start for most Taxes decks. There's also this sort of secondary anti-synergy. Leon and Arbiter prevents shuffling or searching, rather. And, you know, we talked about should these Taxes decks even bother with Stoneforge Mystic because of Leon and Arbiter. And it turns out the answer was yes, you can do that. You can play Stoneforge and Arbiter. It just sequence around it. So that's like a little bit of an issue. That's also, I think, part of the reason why you don't see these Death and Taxes decks splash a second color that often, because you can't really rely on a Fetchland mana base if you're going to play Arbiter. Instead, you're playing a bunch of like Razor Verge Thickets and Horizon Canopies. So if you are splashing us for cards like Noble Hierarch and maybe Collected Company, which is another card that I think correctly you've omitted here, you know, because it doesn't work with Containment Priest.
I mean, I'm not worried about the anti-synergy part of it. I mean, like you say, you can just play around it. There's two Containment Priests. If it's good against them, they'll kill it, and then you can use your other vial again. You don't have to play it if you don't want to. And same with Leon and Arbiter. I mean, it often dies, so the fact that you're just not going to play your Stoneforge Mystic into it. I haven't found those things to be an issue. I've not actually played with Containment Priest in this type of shell before, but the Leon and Arbiter Stoneforge Mystic anti-synergy has, I think, literally never affected me negatively.
I mean, one thing that I think you're actually already halfway to doing is building this less as a Death and Taxes list and more as like a green-white Eldrazi list, in which case you really just maybe would consider adding some Reality Smashers and probably removing the Aether Vials at that point.
Hmm, that's interesting.
Yeah, I can see that. What I like about this is that we're talking about a mostly functional tier 2.5-ish deck, and we're trying out a card that, you know, whatever its synergies we're hoping to unlock here, it also has some applications against other decks in the field. So I'm keen to try this, and hopefully we'll get something out of the Priest. What's the next card in our list?
Yeah, next up we have Griffin Airy. This is an uncommon from M21, and it's 1W for enchantment with, at the beginning of your end step, if you gained 3 or more life this turn, create a 2/2 white Griffin creature token with flying. So tell us about our next deck.
So this card has a relatively high ceiling. If you had a quote-unquote free way to gain 3 life every turn, a 2-mana enchantment that made a 2/2 flying creature every turn is very powerful. It's, you know, a better Bitter Blossom, if you will. But we know that gaining 3 life a turn is not free. We have to kind of bend our deck significantly to do that. And, you know, is the payoff, you know, is the juice worth the squeeze, as my father would say. This is not a card I'm interested in exploring in Modern. So the first two decks we discussed were Modern decks. This is a Pioneer deck I'm going to talk about. You're kind of starting with the baseline of what I think are the sort of 12 best one drops in black, which are Thoughtseize, Fatal Push, and Knight of the Ebon Legion. That kind of gives you the time to do some of the stuff I'm going to talk about here with Griffin Airy, because it is a little bit of a clunky card. One of the things that I kind of took to heart, Damon described playing a similar shell to this, where he said, removal is really good against you. So I'm playing for Adanto Vanguard, a card that is resistant to removal. It also has a weird synergy with Knight of the Ebon Legion against like control decks where your life total isn't very relevant. You can play it on turn 2 and just dome yourself for 4 just to feel alive, and your Knight of the Ebon Legion will get a counter the first time someone did that. I should say, the first time I realized that you could do it from yourself, I think someone Thoughtseize me twice with a Knight of Ebon Legion in play, which I thought was strange. And then you kind of have this multiple way to gain life. So Seeker of the Way and Glorybound Initiate are both cards that on turn 3, if you play Griffin Airy after them, will gain 3 life on your turn and will allow you to trigger Airy. And then in the 3-drop slot, we have Gideon Blackblade, which is another way to give all these creatures, all those creatures listed have 3 power, to give them lifelink, and Othersphere Harvester. And then to kind of top it off, you have a Veto Thorn of the Dusk, which is a synergistic card. I wouldn't call it a combo with all this life gain, where you kind of give these lifelink cards functionally double strike for the turn. And then the Heart of Kieran, Gideon Blackblade is an interaction I've discussed before. I think that's just very powerful in general. Obviously, in the Pioneer that we just described earlier in the format, in the podcast, it's a little control heavy, so I think it's not as powerful as it might be in other metagames, but it is still very good against like mono black, red white, etc.
So let's talk about Griffin Airy. it's so similar to some of the cars we've already talked about in previous weeks, right? It kind of looks like Joel Ryle. It kind of looks like Bitter Blossom, if we're going to be optimistic, or Improbable Alliance, if we're going to be pessimistic. And it triggers off that if you gain three or more life in a turn, which, you know, is the same clause that triggers Silver Smoke Ghoul, which we, I think, spent a whole episode on that the second week of Corset 2021. Now, obviously, that required a lot of graveyard shenanigans, but we did do a pretty thorough vetting of, like, cards that can gain three life that aren't embarrassing to play. So are you seeing any kind of, like, takeaways from, like, playing with those kind of cards that you can apply to this type of strategy, like what we can expect from the Griffinary, or what is the ceiling, what is the floor?
Well, Silver Smoke Ghoul was nominally a similar card because it paid you off for this three life thing, but in another way, it's a very different card. It came down on turn three. If you didn't proactively put it in the graveyard yet, gaining three life when it's in play doesn't do anything if they choose not to block, for instance, because they see that you've given a creature lifelink or whatever. And it was just a little bit clunkier. This is a card you can play out on turn two. It is resistant to sweepers, which is something that decks like this are often weak to. And it can be triggered on turn three to immediately give you a 2/2. So a 2-mana for a 2/2 flying is not great, but is not bad. But if you establish that as a floor on turn three, and you're able to double spell or something, that's already a reasonable card. And any other 2/2 flying creatures you get after that means you're kind of going up from what you'd expect for 2-mana. So I think the floor on this is a little lower than something like Silver Smoke Ghoul, which the floor was often just playing a bad sort of 3-mana 3/1 creature. And without doing anything to put it in the graveyard, you were just sort of stuck, you know, playing it out for its mana cost and then having to go through all these machinations to try to get it back tapped.
I have to say, I'm a little bit skeptical about the card Griffinary. Basically, it takes time to set up. And so the problem is that if you can play it on turn two and then get a creature on turn three, you know, that's great. And then maybe get a creature every turn thereafter. But if you look at the cards in this deck, or just the cards in just generally speaking for what they do, these cards require setup. So, for example, Gideon Blackblade is going to require another creature with 3 power to give lifelink to gain the life. Seeker of the Way, you have to play it and then cast a spell to get a 3/3 lifelinker. Aethersphere Harvester comes down a little bit later. And so if you cast Griffinary for cheap on turn 5 and start making 2/2s, you know, that's okay, but that's still just kind of slow.
It reminds me of what you were saying, Damon, when you tried a Black-White Silver Smoke Ghoul deck, which, if I remember correctly, you're saying that that type of strategy just isn't designed to win in the late game because, you know, the enablers you surround the package with are just, they're kind of small and they only work in this perhaps non-existent, you know, early to mid-game format.
Right. I mean, Glorybound Initiate, I'm not even sure this card scales into the early game very well, but it definitely doesn't scale into the late game.
But what if we were playing more of a controlling, more leisurely type of deck? I always felt like Uro and Klinkthedust were the best ways to gain three life. I'm intrigued by the card Faith's Fetters. It's just an expensive removal spell, but it does gain you 4 life. And some of the cards you've already included here, David, you know, Gideon, Aethersphere Harvester, you know, they don't have to be played aggressively. They could just be every once in a while, I'll gain 3 life and make some birds.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with any card that's generating value in this way is that it's not a Planeswalker. So Planeswalkers just do it for free. Mm. Taking a turn off to play this and then maybe gaining life in the future, and none of the other ways that you're describing other than Uro are like proactive things to be doing. I mean, I don't think that Cling to Dust is a good way to gain 3 life. I mean, it does it. It accomplishes that task, but it does it in, I mean, it's casting Healing Self. I don't want to play that card.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, the question to me is, like, what does it take for this card, Griffinary, to be better than History of Benalia, which will definitely get you 2/2s, which will have one nice attack as 4/3s. And so this card comes out a turn earlier, but requires setup in a way that History of Benalia doesn't.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. A kind of a forgotten card that, you know, is still available and has been very good in Standard. I guess, like, the last sort of thing that intrigued me about it was that because the trigger is the same as Silver Smoke Ghoul's trigger, you can kind of have like a rule of 8 thing going on where you have lots of ways to pay you off for gaining 3 life. And you could even include the card Lone Rider in that situation. That's the 1/1 lifelink that flips to a 4/4. It that rides is 1. If you gain 3 in a turn, and there's other cards like that too, if you want to even go up to 4 life, you have Angelic Accord or 5 life for Resplendent Angel. So if you want to like overload on things that pay you off for getting big chunks of life, you can put Veto, Thorn of the Dusk Rose in that category as well. There's a bunch of those cards in black-white. I just don't know if there's a deck there.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect there's not, but nobody is talking about Griffinary as a playable card, so it's up to us to explore that frontier.
Fair enough, fair enough. All right, let's move along.
So up next, we have Angelic Ascension, another card from M21. And so one and a white for an instant, exile target creature or planeswalker. Its controller creates a 4/4 white angel creature token with flying. So similar to a Beast Within, but one mana cheaper, and it makes it into a 4/4 flying angel instead. So Dan, I know you have some thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, Beast Within, that's the magic words. But that is such a versatile card because it kills anything. You know, whatever is killing you, you blow that thing up, and they get a mostly irrelevant beast. This is a little bit cheaper, but it doesn't kill anything. It only gets creatures and planeswalkers. They get a much bigger, more threatening creature. And it's kind of in that gray area where you're not totally sure if you're supposed to be using it to exile their creatures or possibly to upgrade your own creatures. It kind of has some similarities, I thought, to Archfiend Vessel, where you invest some stuff into it and eventually you get a 5/5 flyer. This is probably card disadvantage if you do that. You know, maybe you can play a 3-man Inspector and then cast Angelic Ascension on that and get a 4/4. But apart from that, you know, I think we weren't that happy with even just like the 5/5 demon from the Archfiend Vessel by itself. It's just not a great time to be investing heavily in these flying tokens. So it's not totally clear, like, what is the ceiling for this card. I thought that it would play nicely with bounce effects, specifically Teferi Time Raveler. That's one that you can, you know, -3. If you have to give them an angel, you can then play a Teferi and clean it up, you know, bounce the angel back and you've recouped your card advantage. Or alternately, if you play Teferi and then minus it and you just have a Teferi sitting around on one loyalty, you can upgrade that into a 4/4 at some point. Narset Parter of Veils is another one that like leaves a leftover Narset on one loyalty that you can upgrade to an angel. So I'm interested in sort of maybe cards like that. Thraven Inspector is another one that seemed plausible. David, what do you think?
Yeah, this is tough. I don't think this is good enough as a removal spell. Having to do extra work to sort of stop yourself from getting 2-for-1 is, it's just asking a lot. There are reasonable 2-mana removal spells you can play. I'll just list some interactions. I don't know if they're all worth actually making a deck around, but I do think turning like temporary tokens into permanent angels is maybe something to explore. So if you have a Ragavan token, if you have tokens from the 3-mana Chandra, an angel from the Geist of St. Traft, if you wanted to play Force of Rage for some unknown reason, you could turn one of those 3-1 elementals into a permanent angel. And then another interaction is if you had it like a Feather Young Pyromancer deck, every turn you're turning one of your elementals into an angel permanently, and Feather's putting it back in your hand because you targeted your own creature. And each casting of it with Young Pyromancer in play is making another elemental. So those are all interactions that people wanted to explore. But yeah, I think maybe your kind of description of what to do with it is maybe the best, Dan, because you're starting from a baseline of all very powerful cards. And so this is just, you know, maybe kind of a role player in a more powerful sort of generic deck. But I mean, my suspicion is that this is the kind of card that is close to getting there, but doesn't quite get there.
Yeah, that's kind of where I landed, is that probably the home I would try this out in is almost like a stock Jeskai Luka Fires control deck, because I want to be playing, you know, 4 Teferis. I want to be playing 4 Narsets. I want token makers, so Castle Ardenvale, maybe Shark Typhoon, maybe even Birth of Meletus, I'm not sure. So basically, if you're doing a blue-white control-ish deck that incidentally makes some tokens, you're probably playing a Luka deck at that point. And Jeskai Luka Fires is still like around the tier 1.5 of Pioneer. There was a list from Festifan that went 7-2 in the challenge over the weekend. So I think I would just sort of take 3 or 4 cards from that list. That's an 80-card Urion list, and just make room for 3 or 4 Angelic Ascensions just to see how it performs. You know, you have, you know, stuff. I'd trim like an Omen of the Sun, maybe Oath of Chandra, and just see how they do.
I will say the one thing that gives me hope that it might be actually useful in this kind of deck is the real problem these Fires decks have dealing with Planeswalkers. You look at this list, and other than like 3 Shark Typhoon, which they can, you know, on turn 3, they can make a 1/1 shark. they just don't have cheap ways to attack planeswalkers. They have three Elspeth Conqueror's Desk as like a one, a five mana sorcery speed way of doing it. And other than that, they really can't do anything unless they're comboing and taking the planeswalker with agent. So this ability to kind of like being able to play out your normal plan, obviously we're all familiar with what like Fighters, Agent of Treachery, Urien, etc., banned in Standard, was trying to do. Being able to like all of a sudden turn one of your kind of useless tokens or whatever, your 0-4 wall that you don't need, into an angel that hits their Narset or Teferi, probably not Teferi, or whatever, is maybe an angle that this deck doesn't have. So you are actually fixing a problem, which is always an encouraging thing for me in terms of how to use a card.
Yeah. So Angelic Ascension is a maybe minus, and we're getting increasingly speculative cards as we go down the list. So what's up next? What's next on our list?
Yeah. Next up, we have Nine Lives. So this is one white for an enchantment with hexproof, and if a source would deal damage to you, prevent that damage, and you lose the first of your nine lives. And when you go through all nine lives, so when there are nine or more incarnation counters on nine lives, exile it. And of course, when nine lives leaves the battlefield, you lose the game. So, David, I know you have a list.
Yeah, so I love this card. I think, obviously, the interaction that everyone thought about with this card was it and Solemnity. Solemnity is an enchantment that does not let counters be added to artifacts, creatures, players, lands, or enchantments. And so with Solemnity and Nine Lives in play, if they can't actually get rid of Solemnity, then you can't take lethal damage. They'll just keep doing damage to you, but Nine Lives won't add any counter. So it's basically a hard lock against a deck like, let's say, Winota or Mono Red or Mono Black. They don't have ways in their main deck to actually beat that combo. But that combo is very soft to people that don't care at all about doing damage. So we're talking about all the control shells that can, you know, eventually just blink Solemnity with, you know, three mana Teferi, Brazen Borrower, etc., counter it. So that's where playing sort of the second angle comes down, which is a Demonic Pact package. So Demonic Pact is a card that I love. We've tried it out in a few various shells to pretty mediocre results. These all kind of get wrapped up together in the Harmless Offering package. So I think people are familiar with the sort of Harmless Offering, the Demonic Pact, once three of its, the positive three uses of it have been used, and then on your opponent's upkeep, they're forced to sacrifice Demonic Pact, and they lose the game. The other thing that's interesting is Nine Lives has a text which says, if it leaves play for any reason, you lose the game. So you can Harmless Offering them Nine Lives, and then you can cast Farika's Libation, which is a black enchantment removal. Why it gets this, we don't know. But it specifically tells a player to sacrifice an enchantment. So the fact that Nine Lives has hexproof does not get around it. So if your opponent does not have another enchantment for six mana, basically, you win the game. You give them the nine lives, and then you libation it away, and you win the game. So built around that is kind of like a Mardu control shell. You're playing Thoughtseize, you're playing Fatal Push, you're playing Dreadbore. You have this kind of hard lock you're looking for with nine lives and Solemnity, and then you know you're playing sweepers, etc. And other than that, you're basically just trying to like live long enough to assemble one or both of these combos, whichever one is good against the type of opponent you're playing against.
So this deck is absolutely crazy. I mean, the combo you're describing, what can Mono Red possibly do against Nine Lives into Solemnity? Well, they could just kill you. But I guess, I don't know, maybe they can't, because if you play Nine Lives on turn three, you're probably going to survive to untap once.
It's also worth noting, Nine Lives has a very interesting text. So it doesn't add counters for each damage you took. It adds counters for each source of damage you took. So it doesn't matter how big their Bone Crusher Giant or how many, you know, triggers they had in their prowess creature. You know, a 4-5 creature puts one counter on. So unless they have nine sources of damage on your next turn, it's always buying you a turn.
I like the Harmless Offering angle, you know, two cat-themed cards here. I don't know. I just, like, don't know if you didn't have the nine lives angle, is there still, like, a functional core to this? I mean, the Demonic Pact, the last time we saw that was in some Doom Foretold lists. This is not a Doom Foretold deck. It doesn't really play any permanents besides these enchantments that are all combo pieces. So are we just sort of positing that, you know, this style of control deck can keep up going into the late game and successfully be a control deck, essentially? You know, you have your card draw, you have your Thoughtseize, your Fatal Push, your Sign and Bloods, your Dreadbores, your Demonic Packs.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hope. I think you're going to struggle against like hard control because you don't get to play a lot of card draw. Sign and Blood is pretty poor compared to some of the Planeswalker sources of card advantage. But yeah, I mean, I don't have a lot of experience playing. I mean, I guess I've played some like red-black mid-range lists, you know, or even splashing blue into Grixis when we were playing like Nikki B and stuff like that. And they are, I think, lesser powered than these other control shells. But kind of having some of these oops, I win interactions is appealing to me. And I think you could also just load up your board with anti-control cards to sort of try to fight that.
The best anti-control cards that Mardu has to offer.
You did make a note that this is a triple combo deck for Damon. He loves those.
Yeah, he loves those. He just has so many ways to win.
Yeah, my one concern is that this deck must have a terrible matchup against a green-white Stetson Champion deck. I mean, you cast Frieza's Libation after you harmless offering them a 9 lives, and they're like, well, which of my 30 enchantments? Meanwhile, you cast 9 lives to buy a turn, but they have 15 monk tokens.
Well, that's why I paid Dan a lot of money to get him to talk people off of it earlier.
Yeah. Unfortunately, like, you run the risk of decking yourself pretty quickly when you get anywhere above like 6 to 7 monks. Constellation is not a may, it's a must. You must draw cards whenever you play enchantments.
Yeah, I remember that being a problem. This deck looks highly experimental.
And yet somehow it's not the last deck we're going to discuss. There are even more speculative ones coming up. So let's touch on those briefly.
Yeah, so next up we have Basri Ket. So this is a 1 white-white for a Basri Planeswalker with 3 loyalty. He is rocking the hairdo that I think he's kind of maybe like 3 or 4 years too late on being in fashion with this, but I guess that's how the art requisition cycles work. put a +1/+1 counter on up to 1 target creature. It gains indestructible until end of turn. -2, whenever 1 or more non-token creatures attack this turn, create that many 1/1 white soldier tokens that are tapped and attacking. And -6, you get an emblem with, at the beginning of your combat on your turn, you get a 1/1 white soldier creature token, then put a +1/+1 counter on each creature you control. So, Dan, I know that even though we kind of downplayed this card when we were talking about M21, you have some thoughts on it.
I mean, it's a bad card. That's my overarching thought. I think you guys said it right away that all of these abilities on this Planeswalker do not function if you do not have creatures in play. And that's just not where you want to be for any kind of Planeswalker. That kind of defeats the purpose of having a Planeswalker if it relies on creatures. So what is even worth doing with this card? Well, it's basically the -2. I was reading an article by Michael Majors on Star City Games. Michael Majors, longtime pro player. He was one of the founders of the game podcast, what is now the Arena Decklist podcast, with Jerry Thompson. Then he went to work for Wizards for a while in R&D. And now that he's retired from Wizards, he's talking about some cards that, like, I guess he worked on designing them and has some sort of insider experience with them. And it seemed like this is a card he was really interested in. I wasn't convinced by anything that he said you could do with it. Like, it all seemed kind of iffy, even in standard. But the -2 ability was the one that, like, looked sort of unique. So the -2 creates 1/1 soldiers that are already tapped and attacking. So it's kind of like a raise the alarm with haste, but it can even scale larger than that. You know, let's say you had 3 or 4 creatures, you know, you play a Basri and now you -2 and you're attacking with like 8 creatures all of a sudden. Like, that's kind of attractive. The +1 adding counters, there's like the Conclave Mentor, the green-white version of Winding Constrictor, but that's about it. And that the +1/+1 counter payoffs aren't there in the white section of the color pie. Especially with Walking Ballista Band from Pioneer. So I'm just basically ignoring that and just trying to focus on the -2. So what I am suggesting is actually, this is perhaps crazy, but dipping into Modern, the stronger format, where you have more options for very, very cheap creatures that cost 1 or even 0 mana to cast, specifically Memnite and Ornithopter. My inspiration here is a deck that Jim Davis brewed up that he affectionately called Loxabots, because it's kind of a robot-themed deck with Toolcraft Exemplars and 3-Bin Inspectors, the Memnites, Ornithopters, even Signal Pests. But then the Loxodon is the venerated Loxodon. This is the 5-mana Convoke Elephant that grows your entire team. when you convoke it. So he had played of some version of this to modest success, both in paper and online. So I'm proposing to update that list by adding a couple of copies of Basriket. So it's an 18 land deck, and in order to make that function, you do need some kind of Mox. And he had Mox Opal. That's obviously banned now for modern. So I'm going to go with Mox Amber. In order to enable the Mox Amber, I have to play some Kithions. I have to play some Isamaru, Hound of Khanda. Thalia, Guardian of Thraben is a 4 of. It's a bit of a nombo with Basri, but Basri is a legend with Mox Amber. So, I mean, there's approaching critical mass of legends. I think I'm rounding it out with a Tomic, Distinguished Advocate, and Offensa as well. Then my Venerated Loxodons on 4. So what do you guys think of this type of deck?
These decks can have really powerful starts. They're kind of like this, instead of playing a Bushwhacker deck with Burning Tree Emissary type cards, these actually dump out these free artifacts into Signal Pest or Venerated Loxodon. And that can certainly overpower a lot of modern decks. On the other hand, the strategy is weak to any number of cards, whether that be Wraths or just some combo decks can go a little bit faster than this.
Yeah, in order to make the Mox Amber happen, like I needed to add more legends, and that meant that I couldn't play Leonin Arbiters anymore. So Jim Davis, when he last played it, you know, he had 4 Ghost Quarters and 4 Leonin Arbiters in addition to his Thalia. So he had kind of the disruptive package of white Texas decks. And then the Mox Opals kind of covered his bases for, you know, drawing all these Darksteel Citadels and stuff in a white weenie deck. He was able to get his colored sources that way off the Mox. Without that, I'm not sure how many colorless lands you can even play. Like, I'm interested in cards like Ghost Quarter or even Mobilized District, the kind of bigger Mistress Factory card, but I just don't know how many non-white sources you can play without access to Opal. And I don't have much disruption because I don't have the Arbiters, so it's more just like hoping to get there quickly with tokens and with Basri tokens and just aggressive starts.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that using Basri with the 0 mana cards is pretty key because you do want to be like -2ing it on, well, possibly turn 2. You know, if you could play it on turn 2 and -2 it and get 3 attacking 1/1s, that's actually, we're talking about it like a very powerful play. I think that's going to happen infrequently enough that it's not going to quite pay off. But I think we won't know until we actually kind of play some games with it. I think you're going to have to be like very judicious with your mulligans. But yeah, like openings of like Memnite, Ornithopter, you know, Isamaru, Hound of Khanda, and then like next turn land, Mox Amber, Basri, you know, get 3 1/1 attacking creatures. That's a great opening. But again, like Damon says, you're just so soft to like one pyroclasm like effect. It just resets you. And Basri is unique or almost unique. And then it's a planeswalker that doesn't do anything with any creature without any creatures on the board.
Next up, we are looking at Stormwild Caprador coming out of Ikoria. So this is 2 and a white for a 1/3 bird goat with flying. And if non-combat damage would be dealt to Stormwild Caprador, prevent that damage. Put a +1/+1 counter on Stormwild Caprador for each 1 damage prevented this way. So, David, I know you have some thoughts on how to utilize this card to best effect.
Yeah, so I really like the card Marauding Raptor. I was actually really excited to see it show up in some 5-0 lists with this red-green dinosaurs build people have been having success with. I was always kind of wanting to use it with Boros Reckoner. That was a card that kind of paid you off for this trigger. It turns into like a little mini Flame Tongue Kabu or something like that. And it's just generally, you know, back when Pioneer was a little more about playing to the board, Boros Reckoner was a reasonably powerful card. But kind of that rule of 8 thing, I wanted another card I could play on turn 3 after Raptor that really paid me off. And Caprador really caught my eye. So it only costs 2 mana. Marauding Raptor reduces its cost. And then it permanently makes it a 3 mana, or I guess 2 mana if Raptor's out, 3/5. And then any other damage it takes, like let's say from Reckless Rage, you can target it with your own Bone Crusher Giant, your own Chandra Torture Defiance, makes it, you know, larger and larger. If they're trying to use damage-based removal, they can't ever kill it. So, you know, if you're playing a mono red deck, this is a very difficult card for them to deal with outside of combat. And then you kind of have this, like, combo finish at the top of this because Star of Extinction and Boros Reckoner does 20 damage wherever you like. And Star of Extinction with Capridor in play basically makes your flying creature lethal, assuming it gets to hit them. And hopefully Star of Extinction is killing all your opponent's creatures so they can't block. And Chandra is both a powerful card with these because it can do four to them and then dome their... in Capridor's case, it basically does four damage to your opponent and makes it permanently large. But it also ramps the Star of Extinction on curve. So you could play Storm Rider Capridor on three, Chandra Charger Defiance on four, you know, whatever, plus one, do two to your opponent. And then on turn five, you can plus two Chandra for two mana, cast Star of Extinction, wipe their board, make Stormrider Capridor or Boris Reckoner, whichever one's down, basically lethal to your opponent. So it has a similar sort of curve as like Chonky Red did. Chonky Red was a deck that Todd Anderson popularized, both the name and the deck in the before times in Pioneer. And I've kind of been waiting for Pioneer to be a little less combo-y to where a deck like this might have a chance.
Yeah, this is a list that you sent us right off the bat during the Ikoria preview season. This is the only non-M21 card on our list, but it's narrow enough that it's an honorary M21 white contender. And I have to say, I really like the look of the deck. I mean, Reckless Rage is a card that impresses me whenever I've seen it cast. Marauding Raptor looked good. I talked about how I got crushed by a red-green dinosaur deck just today, actually. And this line with the Chandra bridging the gap between, your 3-drop and the Capridor and your 7-drop and the Star of Extinction, that's actually pretty slick. And it makes a card like Star, I'm not sure I would play 3 copies, but, you know, there's a 1 or 2 of in what is otherwise interesting chonky Boros kind of strategy is pretty cool.
Yeah, I'll say one thing that kind of raises a flag for me is Todd Anderson was, of course, very excited about the bans, as I think we all were to play in Pioneer. And he was just like, yeah, Chonky Red isn't a deck you should be playing. So the fact that sort of the progenitor, the popularizer, the lodestar of Chonky Red thinks it's bad or not well positioned, and I think he's right, means that this deck, which is, let's just say, a much more speculative version of Chonky Red, maybe in even a worse position, you don't interact that well with other control decks. This is a deck that's made to sort of compete with other decks that are trying to play to the board. Obviously, you've got a great red matchup, but we just talked about how little mono red there is. So there's not a lot of damage-based removal for Capridor and Boros Reckoner to kind of punish your opponent for. It would be very good against other opponents' Chandras. That was a card that was basically soft banned by the Thoros printings. But even after all those cards from Thoros were banned, you're just not seeing a lot of them out there.
Yeah, one last card I'll mention is High Priest of Penance. This is something that came up in one of our community leagues. It was a brew-around card proposed for Pioneer. And some of our players had come up with interesting lists based around, you know, sort of self-damage with Reckoner. The High Priest works really well with the Raptor. It works really well with Reckless Rage. This is a 1-1 for one white, one black. Whenever it takes damage, you get to destroy a permanent. So it's basically like a Vindicate, but you have to work to set it up. That does stretch you into Mardu colors, which is a supported color pair, so I'm not totally sure it's worth it, but it's just another card I think we should consider when trying to build around this package of cards that, you know, deals damage to your own creatures for some effect.
I like this list. I think that even just a Glorybringer swing hitting your own Capridor, that's 9 damage to the face. So it does lines that Chonky Red never had available to it.
Yeah, unfortunately, you can't do that because Glorybringer only hits the opponent's creatures.
Oh, I never quite understood. Okay, I thought I knew every part about it not hitting dragons and all, but I forgot that restriction. Never mind.
I have to say it. We were joking like, oh, you know, maybe Glorybringer's back. You do not see a lot of Glorybringers out there. The mono red lists that are doing well are very low to the ground, I think because of lists like Niv-Mizzet specifically. Glorybringer does not line up well with Urien. We talked about that when Urien was dominant, and it is not a very powerful card against a lot of what Sultai Delirium is doing, or Niv-Mizzet, I think, because Uro is just a huge body, and it just races it very easily.
So that is a whole slew of white cards to try out in the queues, and if you want to find us, you can probably see us in the 02-03 brackets. We'll do our best, of course, and maybe some of this will surprise us. So stay safe out there, and have a good week.
That brings us to the end of episode 67 of the Faith is Brewing podcast. Thanks for hanging out with us. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you're looking for any of the deck lists from today's episode, you can find them in the episode description in your podcast player or on our homepage, faithisbrewing.podbean.com. We also have deck lists plus more extensive league reports in our extended show notes, which are available to all of our patrons at any tier. Patrons also get access to our Discord channel, as well as other cool rewards up to and including our official Faith is Brewing playmats. Patreon.com/Faith is Brewing is where you can sign up for that. We are a listener-supported show, and the contributions of brewers like you are what make it possible for us to bring you a fresh episode every week. Also, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG and leave us a 5-star rating and review. That's all for this edition. As always, stay safe, happy brewing, and we will see you next week.